I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Democrat Phil Murphy is going to be New Jersey's next governor after beating Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno, who was hurt by her association with Chris Christie, New Jersey's very unpopular governor. Murphy was ambassador to Germany under the Obama administration and was an executive with Goldman Sachs for more than 20 years. Here's what he told his supporters last night.
Tonight, we declare the days of division are over. We will move forward together. This is exactly who we are, New Jersey. We have each other's backs. To believe in each of us is to believe in all of us.
Also yesterday, Republican Frank Lobiondo said he would not seek re-election to the House of Representatives, putting his seat up for grabs in that swing New Jersey district. We asked Bridget Harrison to join us. She's a professor of political science at Montclair State University, an astute New Jersey watcher. And Bridget, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Let me give out the phone number, especially to our New Jersey listeners. Give us a call. Tell us what you think of the results. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Bridget, what did New Jersey voters say last night by electing Phil Murphy?
Well, I think there were two messages. The first one was that this was an out-and-out rejection of Governor Chris Christie. Many Republicans even were simply unwilling to give another Republican governor a chance. And I think that that is a function both of Governor Christie's personal style, his rather abrasive personality, but perhaps more importantly, it is a referendum on his years in office and the policies that he's enacted or failed to enact. But I think that we can't deny, particularly because Mr. Murphy's opponent, Kim Guadagno, really pivoted right during the latter weeks of this campaign and started embracing some of the Trump rhetoric, particularly surrounding sanctuary cities and DACA and Dreamers, that in some places this was really a repudiation of President Trump's administration. It certainly isn't the case in all pockets of New Jersey, but I think that that was a message that came across loud and clear last night.
Well, that clip that we just played, he used the word divisions, the sort of end of divisions within New Jersey is over. Time will tell whether that's true or not. But he seemed to be saying to New Jersey residents and voters, this is a new day in the Garden State.
Absolutely. One of the things, I mean, watching Governor-elect Murphy's speech last night, one of the things that I was really rather maybe not surprised at, but perhaps surprised is the right word. He said something along the lines of, we will stand with steeled spines and simply say, no, Mr. President, you will not do that in the great state of New Jersey. And he's talking really not just about things like a federal tax plan that would hurt New Jerseyans who pay the highest property taxes in the country, but also talking about immigration policy and public education and the environment. And I thought it was interesting that Mr. Murphy, on his victory speech, chose to identify President Trump as a real enemy here, not just Governor Christie.
Where did Murphy come from? I know he was high up in the Democratic Party, but he has an interesting bio and obviously never held elective office before.
He did not. He hails from Massachusetts, suburban Boston. He comes from an incredibly working class family where he spoke many times during the campaign about not knowing where his next meal would come from, that his father had not graduated from high school, and the rough times that he faced as a child. And then through the gift of education, he wound up being a very successful executive at Goldman Sachs. Many people perceived that background, the Goldman Sachs component, not the working class component, as being detrimental to his candidacy. But he was able to overcome that, particularly with a very progressive message. This is a candidate who had primary challenges and veered left, was very progressive, but never centered himself. He stayed embracing the progressive policies that he had talked about during his primary campaign. During President Obama's administration, he was appointed ambassador to Germany and really seemed to have some deep connections with the Clintons. And I think that when Mr. Murphy initially decided to run for governor, he probably thought that Hillary Clinton would be in the White House and might be able to help him out if he were governor. In terms of federal funding, that's obviously not the case. But I think the takeaway for Democrats here is that he really succeeded in morphing from a kind of Clintonian Democrat into something that is new for the Democratic Party, that sounds much more like Bernie Sanders than Hillary Clinton.
That's interesting. I mean, New Jersey has traditionally been a blue state, but it sounds like you're saying it might be a dark blue as opposed to a light blue?
You know, I did not. I mean, we've elected a Republican governor for the past two terms. We've elected a Republican governor for the past two terms. Democrats typically win our federal offices, and the majority of our congressional delegation is Democrat, as is our state legislature. My sense is, boots on the ground, I never thought that we were as liberal as some states that typically elect Democrats. We tend to be a kind of working to middle class blue state. But apparently Mr. Murphy's embracing of things like the $15 minimum wage in particular seemed to indicate that Democrats are willing to listen to that message and embrace it.
Well, it's interesting. As we know, New Jersey has a huge public pension that's underfunded. There are, of course, the ongoing questions about the high property taxes, infrastructure, low growth. These are all challenges that the new governor of New Jersey is going to have to deal with. Is there any indication about how he's going to do that?
Well, I think that the first thing is that those will not be the policies that he tackles right off. So I think that he will likely build some political momentum by kind of picking, you know, the low-hanging fruit, things like signing some of the gun laws that Mr. Christie vetoed, that kind of thing. The reality is that Mr. Murphy, was able to win this election with broad support from New Jersey's organized labor communities, including the public employees. And the other reality is that they are going to have to sit down at the table, and there will have to be some renegotiation. And I think that most of the union leadership is aware of that. They've been holding out for Governor Christie, with whom they've had this very antagonistic relationship, to be out of office because they don't essentially trust him that he would fulfill any promises that he makes. Mr. Murphy has an incredibly tough road to hoe. And, you know, he's talked about some of the policies that he would enact, a public bank being one that would save some taxpayer money, growing the economy and some strategies for that. But he's also admitted that he will likely have to raise taxes, and New Jerseyans elected him anyway.
Well, that's so interesting. He did make a reference to New Jersey as a sanctuary state. I don't know whether he stands by that or what that means or where that might take New Jersey and its governor, new governor, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of those comments were taken out of context. And so his embracing of a sanctuary state essentially came up in response to a question about DACA and Dreamers. And so it was propelled by his opponent, Kim Guadagno, to mean that, you know, he would have the backs of serial killers. That, in my interpretation, was really not at all what Governor Murphy was saying. He was saying that we have an obligation, particularly for Dreamers, in whom we've invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in their education, to have their backs and not support the federal law. You know, we'll see how that plays out. You have to remember that New Jersey is amongst the most largely populated state with immigrants, and we have a huge number of first-generation Americans. So almost everyone in the state is connected to an immigrant in some way. Perhaps they're employed by one, perhaps they're married to one. So there is, you know, we are an incredibly diverse state. We are also a very tolerant state. And, you know, my read of Mr. Murphy's take on this is particularly objecting to the rhetoric that has come out of Washington with regard to immigrants that are an incredibly important part of New Jersey's economy.
Let me ask you about the announcement yesterday, Republican Congressman Frank Lobiondo saying he will not seek reelection. Bridget, was that a surprise, and what do you think this means?
It is a bit of a surprise, simply I've been watching this with a bit of interest, and my take was that I thought that Mr. Lobiondo would remain in office for another term until 2020. He has about, I don't know, about $400,000 in his campaign account, so I was a bit surprised when he announced that he would no longer seek a reelection. What this means, that second district seat is held by a Republican, but most analysts, if you look at how the demographics have changed, it is certainly a very competitive seat, and it indeed could probably numerically should be a Democratic seat, just looking at the party registration. It is a district that voted for Mr. Trump last year, but before that had it voted for President Obama twice.
Interesting. So a place to watch. And Bridget, also to, I guess, add to the drama here is that the jury is deliberating on the trial of Senator Bob Menendez. He, of course, is a Democrat. Obviously, we don't know what the decision will be, but are people in New Jersey closely watching this potential verdict and what it could mean for the state?
With bated breath.
That was a leading question, by the way. Yes, right.
Myself included, was just hoping that the verdict wouldn't come yesterday. So we're thankful to the jury for that. But, I mean, the Menendez here, you know, yes, there will be a verdict. And whatever that verdict is, I can almost assure you that Senator Menendez will not be stepping down from the U.S. Senate, even if he is convicted. My sense is that he will arduously appeal a decision, and it really would take an expulsion from the Senate, which is highly unlikely at this point. I think that what many people are looking for is, you know, will whatever, if he is to vacate that seat by whatever mechanism, if that occurs before January 19th, then Governor Christie would have the power to appoint someone to that seat. And so most people are saying that Bob Menendez needs to hang in there until after January 19th. But I find it hard to believe that he would step down.
Just final thing, I mean, then we have to say goodbye to you. We should say that Sheila Oliver becomes New Jersey's first black lieutenant governor, just to, I guess, add to some of the news out of New Jersey from yesterday's election. Bridget Harrison, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's a professor of political science at Montclair State University, and as I said at the top of the hour, an astute New Jersey watcher. And we are talking about some of the results of yesterday's election. We'll be talking about Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Delaware County, and some other races as well with WHYY's Dave Davies after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
This is a story about a movement.
That's right, sir.
And this is a movement that is tired of seeing a system that is systematically picked on poor people, primarily black and brown people.
Larry Krasner is going to be Philadelphia's next district attorney after beating Republican Beth Grossman in an election that wasn't even close. Democrats hold a huge voting advantage over the GOP in this city. The race got national attention because of Krasner's progressive politics, the fact that he had sued the Philadelphia Police Department dozens of times and has zero prosecutorial experience. He will head up a team of some 600 lawyers who prosecute thousands of crimes every year in a department with a budget of some $38 million. We asked Dave Davies, WHYY senior reporter, to join us in this segment of Radio Times to talk about Larry Krasner's win. Also, the ballot question before Pennsylvania voters about the property taxes that was passed. They've also took a deep dive into the into an election in Delaware County. We, of course, got judicial races as well. So, Dave, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about what happened in Philadelphia and also in Pennsylvania? So, taking the Larry Krasner win, I guess, Dave, in many ways, no surprises, but he was in many ways a surprising candidate.
Yeah, you know, everybody says elections have consequences, but some are more consequential than others. This is a big deal. I mean, if you spend time around Larry Krasner, as I've done over the past, 8 months, it's hard not to be impressed with the depth and coherence of his critique of the criminal justice system, that for years police and prosecutors have been overcharging, over-convicting, over-sentencing, over-incarcerating, which breaks up families, harms communities, and squanders public resources. That's an argument that a lot of people are buying, including a lot of conservatives. Fixing it is not going to be easy, and it will be fascinating to see how he takes this on. You know, institutions don't change easily. Resources are limited, and something's going to go wrong. I mean, he can change the department's bail requests and charging policies and stem the flow of young men to prisons. But at some point, the defendant's going to get released and do something awful, and there's going to be blowback, and it will just be fascinating. I will say, when I look at his campaign finance report, I saw some plane trips to places around the country. He is talking to progressive prosecutors elsewhere, getting some practical advice on what works and what doesn't.
Interesting.
And that's smart.
Well, he does, just to recap here, he does oppose the death penalty. He's been a critic of cash bail, opposing the asset forfeiture procedure. His relationship, of course, with the police department is rocky. He's been a critic of stop and frisk. He's, this is a liberal city in many ways. Do those positions fit Philadelphia, do you think, Dave?
Well, parts of them, yeah. I mean, we had a DA here for 19 years, Lynn Abraham, right, who was very popular for being very tough. I mean, communities care about public safety. And so I think, when the neighborhood bully assaults your kid, you want justice and you don't want the kid released the next day. So there's that side of it, too. And hundreds of prosecutors deal with these issues and victims of crime all the time, and he's going to have to manage all that. I think there are a lot of conflicting interests here, but I think generally a lot of people believe that we have to take a different approach to incarceration, and he's determined to do it.
Now, Beth Grossman got 50,000 votes. You and I were talking about this before going on the air, which was, especially in a city like Philadelphia, not a bad showing for a Republican.
Yeah, it's 2.5 times what the last Republican candidate for DA got. And she won wards in the Northeast and other places, but there is the Democratic machine in the main stood by Larry Krasner, and this enthusiastic following that he has really turned out. I mean, I think partly that's driven by the Trump factor, people's anger over the presidential election, but he has a constituency, and it came out.
And who is his constituency?
Well, I mean, I think it's progressive Democrats generally, but there was an analysis which showed that millennial people from the ages of 18 and 34 like tripled their turnout in the Democratic primary. Now it was so anemic before that it's still not a big number, but it increased their relative weight in the voting population, and I think that happened again.
As everyone has said about this race, it did get national attention. Is that just because he seems to represent a new kind of prosecutor? A prosecutor was not prosecuted before, or what he represents when it comes to the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I think he's part of this wave of prosecutorial candidates who want to take a different approach to criminal justice. And the fact that George Soros put just shy of $1.7 million into an independent expenditure on his behalf also got a lot of attention.
Yeah, and that was in the primary.
In the primary, yeah.
So his job is what, to win over the lawyers that work in the DA's office? Do you think that's number one?
Well, I think that's part of what he needs to do. He needs to build a working relationship with them and with the police department and with the judges and parole officers in the criminal justice system, and then try to make institutional changes that he thinks will advance in the directions he wants to go. He hasn't outlined that in detail, and I don't know enough about it to know exactly what to expect. But I think this will be a fascinating story to watch unfold over the next year.
Did Mayor Kenney weigh in on this race at all, Dave?
He endorsed Larry Krasner.
He did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That very familiar voice is Dave Davies, WHYY senior reporter. And we are talking about last night's election, focusing in this first portion of our segment on Radio Times on the district attorney race here in Philadelphia. Larry Krasner will be the new DA. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. If you're happy with the results, you're unhappy with the results, tell us why or why not. Where do we go next, Dave? Well, let's talk about Delaware County. This was a place that you decided to take a deep dive on to look at a race there. Why?
Well, it's actually several races.
Several races.
And I think in some respects this may be the most interesting result of yesterday's balloting. Delaware County is among the four suburban counties in Philadelphia, the one with the highest poverty rate, the lowest median income. It has a blue-collar industrial waterfront corridor and a lot of unions, and yet it has been dominated by this really effective Republican political operation for decades. And the Democrats have slowly been gaining in registration and been competing, and they thought that this year they had a chance to really deliver a body blow to this Republican machine. There's a five-member county council that's been in effect for 41 years. The Democrats have never won a seat.
Never won a seat.
Never won a single seat.
Wow.
Two of those seats were up in this election, and so they had candidates that got behind them. They were outspent 2-3-1. But yesterday, those two county council candidates won, and they swept three row offices, the sheriff, the city, the county controller, and the register of wills. They're obscure offices. People won't know the names. But what's really at stake here, the Democrats will argue, is a Republican pattern of building this operation, which uses patronage and contracts and in some cases, they would argue, city services to try and enforce discipline on their voters. And that all connects to a fundraising network, which makes them very powerful, reinforces their power, and helps them win congressional races. And if that machine begins to crumble, the Democrats say, and they're convinced that it now is, it'll be a different Republican Party. It will be a different Republican Party in the suburbs. So I think that victory yesterday is in some ways among the most significant things that we've seen. And I will add that it is partly fueled, you know, by the anger over the election of Donald Trump.
Well, that was my next question. And so many people are trying to figure out these Democrats that had won in races where they hadn't won before, or there was some question about whether they would win, whether this is really a referendum on the president or not. And you're saying in Delaware County, perhaps it was?
To a degree. But just the county has been changing. I mean, in 2000, which is less than 20 years ago, the Republicans held a 2-1 registration. There were 120,000 more Republicans than Democrats. They've been losing that margin, and now there are 16,000 more Democrats than Republicans. So that's a big part of it. The county itself has been evolving, and so Democrats are in a stronger position. They also won seats in they took over the Upper Darby Township Council. Upper Darby, if it were a city, it would be the sixth largest city in Pennsylvania.
It's right outside of Philly.
Yeah, and so that's a big deal. There are school boards here and there. So in all, impressive gains for them. And I think the Democrats also made some gains in Chester County in row offices. So I think you're seeing growth in Democratic prospects generally in the burbs.
Well, let's talk about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Now, people in Pennsylvania, we do get to vote for judges. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, right.
But nonetheless, we do. Tell us about the Supreme Court race.
Well, the Democrat was I'm sorry, I'm blanking.
I'm blanking as well.
Yeah, Woodruff.
There you go.
Dwayne Woodruff, who is a former Pittsburgh Steeler and a common pleas court judge. The Republican is Sally Mundy, who was actually an incumbent justice. She was appointed by Governor Wolf, even though she's a Republican, to fill the term of Michael Aiken, who people will remember lost his seat in the Porngate scandal. So Sally Mundy comes in with the advantages of an incumbency. But the Democrats consciously made this a referendum on Trump. Their ad on judicial elections began angry about Donald Trump. Wow. Send a message, vote for the Democrats. And I know a lot of Democrats are steaming, furious that Mr. Woodruff didn't run much of a campaign. He was a weak candidate. He didn't raise money. And therefore, he came, you know, like 6 or 8% short of winning that race. Sally Mundy, I will have to say, did a great job of fundraising. Interesting that the Philadelphia trial lawyers, who are by far the biggest donor to judicial candidates, ignored the Democrat. They tend to lean Democratic. They ignored Woodruff, the Democrat, and put, I think, $150,000 into Sally Mundy's campaign.
No, that's interesting.
It is interesting. I mean, she was rated highly qualified by the bar, and it didn't hurt that her husband, Jim Mundy, is a former president of the State Trial Lawyers Association.
Oh, okay. It's all very, very cozy here in the Commonwealth. What was her message to the voters? And it's what's strange in Pennsylvania is judicial candidates can't tell you how they're going to rule on cases, but I guess there you're looking at me saying, well, maybe not so much. But what was her message?
Well, the message was she smart, she's qualified. Her ads, most of the Republican ads did not mention party. She did have one ad with her in earmuffs and goggles on a gun range, firing off rounds and then turning to the camera and saying, you know, when I tell you I'll protect the Second Amendment, you better believe it. So there was that appeal. You know, what's interesting about this, Marty, is that the Supreme Court now has a partisan balance of 5-2 in favor of the Democrats. Now, of course, judges only look at the facts and the law. They would never let politics enter into a decision.
Never.
However, I mean, there are going to be cases involving gerrymandering that come before this court soon. And so if Democrats, you know, believe that there's a case to be made that redistricting processes ought to be altered, you have a court that's positioned to do that. Mm-hmm. Also, for redrawing legislative boundaries, that's actually done by a 5-member commission, 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and then the 5th member is typically chosen by the Supreme Court. And so, again, chances for a Democratic-friendly appointee to that board. So I think the partisan balance of this court, which remains 5-2 in favor of the Democrats, gives Democrats some hope that the redistricting, that the drawing of both legislative and congressional boundaries in the state, which they regard as terribly unfair and favoring Republicans, could change.
Oh, fascinating. WHYY's reported, I think, that all the women candidates won, judicial candidates won in Pennsylvania. Is that true, Dave? Do you know?
In the statewide appellate judgeships, I believe that is the case. Yeah,
which is fascinating. Well, let's dig into this ballot question. And this was a ballot question that Pennsylvania voters could vote on, having to do with the property tax. The language was complicated. We actually did a show about it a week or so ago to try to deconstruct what the language was here. How did you see the question before voters yesterday, Dave?
Well, I think people were really confused about it.
Yes.
It's interesting that the Democratic Party, which always takes in Philadelphia, which always takes a position on ballot questions, when you got their recommended sample ballot that was handed out at 1,600 polling places yesterday, there was nothing on there about that, about that question. It was confusing. What it does is it changes the state constitution to enable the state legislature to in turn enable local communities to provide a lot of property tax relief specifically for people who live in and own their own homesteads. It has to be your home and your primary residence. It permits these local jurisdictions, again, if the legislature enacts the legislation, and given that they passed the bill to get this on the ballot overwhelmingly twice, it seems likely that they would.
Right.
A local municipality can give a lot of tax relief to owner-occupied, you know, residences, primary residences. Now, the problem is that if you're losing revenue for your school district or your county or your township, there will be a need to replace that revenue with something. And, you know, school advocates were strongly against this because, you know, property taxes undergird, you know, the public schools in Pennsylvania. A lot of people think that's a bad way to do it. It creates terrible disparities, but it's what we have at the moment. And that if that funding leg is kicked out from it, without another one in place, it will harm schools. Or it'll raise taxes which tend to be regressive, like the sales tax. So there's a lot of debate about it. But others say, well, you could use this to give homeowners tax relief and, in effect, have a greater tax burden on commercial properties, which some people think would be better. So there's been a fair amount of confusion about it, and we'll just have to see how it plays.
Yeah, and I'm assuming income tax or raising the income tax would be a potential solution to this change in taxes for schools.
Right, although, you know, the state income tax is levied statewide by the legislature, whereas the property taxes are imposed by local jurisdiction. So it would get complicated.
We don't know, of course, what the legislature is going to do about it, but they're still having trouble trying to figure out how to balance their
yes, exactly.
budget. So
fiscal management, not its strong suit at the moment.
We add this to their pile of lists of things to do.
Right.
What was the enthusiasm in Philadelphia for the district attorney's race?
Well, you got to remember that most Philadelphians stayed home. I mean, turnout was like, you know, four out of every five voters didn't show up. That having been said, there was a far more robust turnout for this DA's race than any that I could find. I mean, 4 years ago, it was about 12%.
Ugh.
This is a little over 20%.
All right.
So a lot of people were animated by what we have to say was a pretty clear, distinct choice among these two candidates.
Yeah. We didn't talk about the city controller, but Democrat Rebecca Reinhart will be the new city controller. Interestingly, she beat Alan Butkovitz in the primary.
Yeah, that was the big surprise
yes.
in the spring. I mean, I don't think anybody saw that coming. And so what that means is that we will now have a controller for the first time in decades that is not from the Democratic political organization. Mm-hmm. Reinhart is kind of a different an insider of a different kind. She comes from the government finance department. But, you know, she's the first woman to ever inhabit that office.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are saying, well, when are we going to have a woman mayor? And, you know, who knows? Looking down the line, I think that's way ahead of the game. But she's off to an interesting start.
Let me just read an email, and then I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, Dave. An emailer says, the problem Mr. Krasner faces is working with judges, police, et cetera, is that the entire law enforcement, courts, prisons, and lawyers is a self-perpetuating profit-making industry. So clearly, Mr. Krasner's got his work cut out for him. Dave Davies, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And he is WHYY senior producer. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking about Virginia and Donna Brazil with our guest Dave Weigel from The Washington Post. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about some local races in Philadelphia, Delaware County, and New Jersey, and now we want to take a look at what happened in Virginia last night. In what was predicted to be a close race for governor, Democrat Ralph Northam beat Republican Ed Gillespie early and easily. Republicans fared poorly in down-ballot races as well. Dave Weigel wrote in the Washington Post, the result is a bad omen for the Republican Party nationally. He covers politics for the Post and joins us to talk about Virginia and about Donna Brazile's new book called Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Some powerful Democrats are very angry at her. Dave Weigel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. So what did the pundits, the pollsters, the predictors, what did they get wrong? Because it looks like Ralph Northam beat Ed Gillespie by about 9 percentage points.
Well, I want to congratulate Quinnipiac, which is a pollster based in New Jersey that has been criticized for overestimating how well Democrats would do for the last couple of years. And it looks like they were just waiting for an election where Democratic enthusiasm was off the charts.
Is that what it was, Democratic enthusiasm for this guy?
Oh, yeah. Gillespie did not underperform relative to previous Republican candidates. It was that Democrats blew the doors off, especially on suburbs that have been trending their way. And they outperformed every poll except the Quinnipiac one. They outperformed I think also importantly they outperformed the psychology of Democrats, because there was this worry after Trump that every election in our future – in America's future might see Republican voters not be picked up by pollsters and then surge at the last minute, as we saw in 2016. They worried in Virginia about Gillespie in particular, because in 2014 he almost won a Senate race with not quite as much of a surge, but with a fall off in Democratic turnout. And that did not happen. It was a surge up and down the ballot for Democrats. They didn't do as poorly in the rural parts of the state as they have done, and they did extremely well winning, I think at this count, it's 15 House of Delegates races, they flipped a gerrymandered chamber from 2-1 Republican majority to tied, which, and I apologize if the listener had predicted that. I could not find anyone who predicted they would do that.
That's fascinating. I mean, was it that they were so excited about Ralph Northam, or they were repudiating the Republican Party, the president? How do you see it?
It's a combination. I think the Northam campaign took a little bit too much heat for mistakes that were not that bad, as the campaign goes. I mean, they produced one piece of literature on the request of a union that didn't include the black running mate. They had an outside group run an ad about immigration that was seen as offensive. The candidate did not make many mistakes. He also ran not a centrist campaign. This is something I think is being spun today. He ran a kind of modified Clinton liberal campaign where he ran on protecting the environment, expanding the minimum wage, decriminalizing marijuana. He was just personally so low-key and always led with how he was a doctor and a veteran that I think he came off as a kind of Mr. Rogers figure. But what I've seen covering elections for 13 years is I've seen this with Republicans a lot. I remember in Missouri last year, Roy Blunt was running as kind of a plotting figure and against a much more dynamic Democrat and won because the electorate pushed towards a Republican victory. This electorate wanted a Democrat. This electorate could not stand and cannot stand Donald Trump. It was voters who said they were voting based on their opinion of the president by a 2-1, big 2-1 margin. Voters said that they were doing so to oppose the president.
Interesting, because Ed Gillespie did not invite the president to come and campaign with him, but he did talk about issues that it seems the president has talked about, whether it's Confederate statues or the MS-13 gang violence. What was the president's response to Gillespie's loss?
Who's Ed Gillespie? Gillespie? I've never heard of the guy. Yeah, the president tweeted from the Pacific Rim last night that Gillespie did not do the right thing and come up close to him and embrace him. It's not wrong because Gillespie, who I think attitudinally was never comfortable with Donald Trump, although never opposed him, tried to excite Republican voters on kind of cultural issues like keeping Confederate statues and stopping sanctuary policies for immigration without embracing the president. And he was visibly irritated. Every reporter who covered this race has a story of him kind of gritting his teeth and smiling as you asked about the president. Never wanted to embrace him. And Republicans up until, I'd say, 7 p.m. yesterday thought he'd done a very good job of this. It just didn't happen. I think anecdotal stuff that was not correctly studied before the votes came in was he could not get anyone to show up at his rallies in Republican areas. He brought Mike Pence to the most Republican part of Virginia in the Southwest, and 500 people showed up. And that's not great for the vice president, I should say, for context. It should be more like 3,000 or 4,000. It is time, I think, for Republicans to consider that they might be in a situation like the one Democrats were in when Barack Obama was president, where there is a popular figure, although not that popular with most voters, but a figure who inspires people, inspires his base, who cannot get that base to turn out unless he's on the ballot.
Well, interesting, because there is that core base for the president. About 30% of people in this country do support him. He hasn't really won over any new support. Does it show the president as vulnerable, and do you think that does empower the Democrats?
It does. This doesn't have a direct impact on the debate in Washington, but if you are a Republican thinking about running in 2018, maybe you want to go for broke. Maybe you want to pass as many bills as possible. If you want to be reelected, you are finding that what you might have been planning on doing, saying, well, you know, the president is making some mistakes and I'll fight him where, you know, the muddled position that Gillespie came up with is just a loser. It's not going to work. You might well be from a area that's more Republican than Virginia is. Lots of places are now. But you can no longer dismiss all these progressive groups that grew up in the wake of the Hillary Clinton defeat. I think until last night, it's a very sharp distinction. It was very easy for Republicans to say, well, we saw what happened in Georgia's special election for the House when John Ossoff supposedly had all these groups on the ground helping him out and he lost. Well, you can't look at that anymore because that was a distinct race, a candidate with some problems. A lot of these guys are running against, you know, born and bred solid candidates. Solid candidates born and bred in their districts, people with military records like Ralph Northam. doctors like Ralph Northam, who might actually be more adroit as candidates. And they're going to come up with their issues. I think the entire Republican campaign, which I'm dreading, not because I dislike Republicans, but because I dislike repetition. The entire Republican campaign will be about Nancy Pelosi. That's going to be the whole thing.
And that's Dave Weigel. He covers politics for The Washington Post. We've been talking about the the election in Virginia yesterday, where the Democrat Ralph Northam pretty handily beat Republican Ed Gillespie. And a lot of people are saying this could be a bellwether for the future. Let me just ask a comment from Fred, and then I do want to talk about Donna Brazile. Fred asks, was the turnout in New Jersey, which we talked about, and Virginia greater than in other off-year elections? And how does the percentage win compare to previous elections? Talking about Virginia, Dave, was there a pretty big turnout yesterday?
Yeah, it was massive. We're still waiting for a couple of final numbers, but it was bigger. It was not quite presidential level turnout. It was close to that in some Democratic areas. In Charlottesville, for example, I don't think I need to get into the resonance of this election in Charlottesville. That turnout was up 31% over the last governor's race, which is unusual. And again, not what you would expect in a race where a lot of pundits are wagging their fingers about how neither candidate was terribly inspiring.
Well, but Charlottesville, do you think what happened in Charlottesville in the summer got a lot of people to the polls?
In Charlottesville specifically, and black voters. So one thing that surprised Republicans last night and today as they look at who voted, they honestly thought that black voter turnout was going to fall because, again, that people fight the last war. They fight it in all aspects of their lives. For years, black voters did not come out unless Barack Obama was on the ballot. It is not hard to, as a reporter, find a black community that says they've not been contacted recently by Democrats or they're not inspired to vote. Under the radar, there was a lot of outreach by groups like Black Pack, by individual Democratic groups and candidates, a lot to just inform people of the election and remind them of what happened this summer, where white nationalists came to Charlottesville and showed their strength and murdered someone at the end of it. I think a lot of people misinterpreted how that was playing, because if you polled Virginia, and as the exit pollsters did, most Virginians, who are mostly white, said we should keep Confederate statues. But the people who cared the most about the issue were black voters who did not, even if they could care one way or another about Confederate statues, when they heard people talking about that as their number one issue, flashback to Charlottesville. I would add to that the messaging for black voters was about self-respect like that. It was also Republicans had bottled up the Medicaid expansion, which is going to be very beneficial to black voters, to all matter people who are kind of in that loop where they don't have quite enough money to buy health care on the exchange. They're not poor enough for Medicaid. That was an issue that Democrats messaged on too, and it just Republicans, because they were going after Trump voters, did not have a response to black voters. It was not a counteroffer that let this turnout spike in a way people did not expect.
Well, let me ask you about Donna Brazile. Her new book just published this week called Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns that Put Donald Trump in the White House. She was vice chair of the Democratic National Committee last summer after Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepped down. And she claims that the DNC and the Clinton campaign had a fundraising deal that disadvantaged Bernie Sanders in the primary. She says other things as well. But I wonder, as a result of yesterday's elections, whether she is now being forgiven for some of the things that she said because the Democrats did so well.
Forgiven's I'm not sure if it's going to go that far. She's, I think, doing Fox News today to talk about the book. And Donna's, I've covered her as a reporter, know her a little bit, witty and smart and can handle herself on Fox. But there's an opinion in Democratic politics that you should not even indulge the guys, that they become a propaganda network. What are you going to get out of this? I don't think so. Democrats were not spinning when in the last couple days they'd go on TV and be asked if this book was hurting them in Virginia. They would say it wasn't. It really wasn't. I mean, if you were not watching cable news all the time, as most people do not, you weren't super aware of this book. What they are irritated by is that they have been trying to rebuild all year, and it is very hard for them to get past the legacy of the 2016 primary Brazil has one theory of the case, which is that we need to air out everything that went wrong, that in this case, that the Hillary Clinton campaign did to kind of manipulate the future work of the DNC. You know, they cut a joint fundraising deal that was going to be good for them if they won the nomination. She thinks it's important to air all that stuff out. You have the primal scream, you move on,
right.
Whereas other Democrats spent the year wanting to bottle it, and that's the fight. Now, the thing about the whole argument about whether the campaign was rigged, that's what it became, because I think that's the easiest way to ask the question. And Brazil, again, I think is confident that she can explain what actually happened, but ends up getting trapped in this loop where people ask if it was rigged. She says it wasn't, and then people think she flip-flopped. She never said it was rigged. She said it was the Clinton people use their muscle and influence to get a better deal with a DNC that had fallen apart. She's more angry that the DNC had been allowed to become irrelevant as an institution for 5 years under Barack Obama. But that's not as exciting as a story as the rigging. So you see, it's all very messy. There are people who are convinced the Democratic primary was rigged who don't understand how the Democratic National Committee works. For example, thinking that it's the reason why some voters were left off the rolls in New York, which is not something they
control.
Because
it's the states that really control what happens within their borders when it comes to voting. Let me ask you just a couple of questions before we have to say goodbye here. She also at least indicated at some point considering when Hillary Clinton got ill and wobbled as she left early from a 9/11 memorial service that she might replace her with Joe Biden. Was that just her like thinking if there's a problem or was she overstepping her bounds there?
Well, I think she was being very honest because if there was a gut check, I think there are a lot of jittery Democrats. Democrats by nature are pretty jittery, as seen by last night where they thought they were going to lose a race where they kept leading the polls. Who thought when that happened, do we need a plan B? So she was getting calls from people asking about Hillary and wondered if they also were auditioning to be candidates. So I think this has been misinterpreted. Having read the book, she's not saying she was about to march in there, take Hillary off the ballot, that she just had kind of a dark night of the soul. Maybe it lasted 2 or 3 minutes, thinking, my God, am I going to have to break this ticket and put in a new one that can win the election? And again, the thing that I think a lot of Democrats don't understand is the new media is a cliche, but the media in 2017, it is not just you go on TV, you say your message, you go home. It is you go on TV, somebody clips half of one sentence, they put it on Facebook, that Facebook post gets 200 posts, and it gets kind of twisted in telephone game. And I keep seeing Democrats get tangled up by this. I think she made that point, and it has become something that about how she believed Hillary was always too sick to be the candidate. Not what she said at all. That's how this stuff gets mangled, and that's in a very meta way has been interesting to watch about Brazil's book launch. Is that she is a extremely smart and savvy operator, but she's working in a 2017 where, you know, alt-right blogs and Twitter with fake accounts and Fox News, Fox and Friends running what it wants, where they can define what you believe more than you can.
Well, Dave Weigel, we're going to have to end on that note. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he covers politics for The Washington Post. Well, for many years, I closed the show by saying Radio Times engineer is Kevin Griffin. And we have some sad news. Kevin died this past weekend after a long battle for his health. He was one of a kind. He was generous, positive, caring, dedicated, and a real friend to those of us who had the pleasure of working with him. He and I chatted about everything as we got ready for the show, including family and music and politics and the TV shows that we enjoyed, and of course, food. Kevin was a fabulous cook. His cooking was legendary and delicious. So while we are sad to have lost him, we are also lucky to have known him and to have worked with him. Kevin Griffin, rest in peace. Peace.